Okay, I like this part of the weekend very much. And one of the things you learn over the years is there isn't just one answer to these questions. So you're going to hear what Jack sees as the answer to the question today. And he may come back 10 years from now and get the same question, give a different answer. And that's just the way life is. And if we don't get through all of them, if your question doesn't get answered, just write it out on a piece of paper and give it to me and with your address, and I'll type up an answer and send it to you. So every question will get answered either now or later. Boy. And so we're going to start out, and I'm going to let Jack start out and select one of the questions out of here, and we'll just answer them as briefly and as clearly as we can. You got it, sir.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I'm Jack, and I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Jack.
And I reached into the Ascot basket here, Sandy, and the somebody who went to the Sunflower Roundup, the 28th Sunflower Roundup in Kansas City, Kansas, wants to know, how do you speak / talk about, quote, singleness of purpose, unquote, to the ANDA?
Oh, you can answer that just as well as I can.
Well, I know, but I thought you would read me the question the next time, so I thought I'd read you the question. And then I'll be happy to amplify your answer.
All right. Okay. The answer to that question is answered by our history, that it didn't take long for the Fellowship of AA to realize, once they got going, that these steps could solve any problem, any human problem. And you could have eating problems, sex problems, gambling problems, you name it. And they said, wow, isn't that amazing how powerful these principles are? Maybe we should just open the door and let anyone with a problem in. And when they thought about it, somebody who throws up their food every day in order to stay thin, trying to help a gambler, might not work. And they decided that they would just solve one problem, and that was alcoholism. And they would give the steps to everybody else. Because if they didn't do that, they would dilute the identification of one person to another. Because someone who drank a lot cannot connect to somebody with needles. They just aren't the same story, and the new person just isn't going to connect powerful enough to turn their life over to this person unless they feel he completely understands them. And so that's why we limit it to just alcohol. And there weren't any problems till the treatment centers came along and tried to tell everybody that everything's the same. And it would greatly dilute AA. And so when I sponsor people, I just say, just drop the ANDA, and you're suddenly going to feel like you're a real member of AA. And they all do. Thanks.
I'm going to share as Jack sees it.
We're going to just each answer one question.
Oh, well, let me answer this one then.
All right.
I didn't know they were going to answer one question, but I know you tried to explain it to me.
Okay.
But I didn't hear what you said. I heard what I wanted to hear. I think the difficulty associated with ANDAs is that somebody gets taught this somewhere along the line. I don't know that anybody just starts being an alcoholic ANDA. And so it's the lack of understanding that this is a spiritual solution to a spiritual malady. And should there be an ANDA, I try to talk to the person privately and suggest that whenever we add ANDA, we put a spiritual barrier between myself and the rest of the room or the rest of the people. Now, I don't understand how that works. I just know it does work. And I think everybody in here knows that's the way it works, because when I'm alcoholic and a drug addict and a chalkaholic and a sex addict and a Democrat and a Vietnam vet, with each statement, I am farther and further and further away from the program of recovery. So it's a spiritual program, and I just need to suit up and show up and be a alcoholic. Thanks
okay,
for letting
thanks.
Me share that.
Why isn't every Thatcher considered a founder of AA? I guess you could if you want to in your mind. It's just that the rest of the people don't agree. Your turn.
Okay.
How do we reconcile simply allow everything to be as it is with the reality of suffering, like a child being raped and murdered, or physical suffering from a disease? Lack of power is my dilemma. I wish I had the power. I wish I could make all unpleasant things pleasant. But I had to learn here that I'm powerless. I'm not only powerless over alcohol, I can't make anybody sober and I can't make anybody drunk. I just don't have the power. It's my understanding that life happens, and part of life includes suffering. And I cannot explain, nor does anybody else I know have the capacity to explain why suffering happens. But if it weren't for the bad times, I wouldn't be able to recognize the good times. And I mentioned last night, I think it'll be 11 days from today, is the 21st anniversary of my being blown up. It didn't seem like a good day at the time, but it turns out to be one of the best things that ever happened to me. So I'm not sure about suffering. I'm not sure why it happens, but it happens for a reason, and it's the way it is supposed to be right here, right now. Thank you.
Good job, Jay. Is it possible to spiritually outgrow your sponsor? If so, how do you know and what do you do? I guess that's of course it's possible. I mean, that's like five people taking piano lessons and one becomes a virtuoso and the other one isn't, or you get smarter than your father or whatever. But that doesn't mean that they can't still be your sponsor. It doesn't mean you can't continue to respect them. You can't. I think that I went off into areas that my sponsor didn't choose to seek out. But he remained my sponsor and was my primary backup. But I began to seek also people who were familiar with the areas that I was interested in, and they became friends or sounding boards and so on down. You got to be careful, because we realize that we're judging ourselves to be somewhere, and so it's a slippery slope, and I would ask some other people, see if they agree with you. And then just see what you think after what they say. But yes, I would say it is, of course. Thank you. Thank you.
All right, the big book says we are rocketed into the fourth dimension of existence. Can you please explain exactly what is meant by that? And what are the first, second, and third dimensions? And are they spelled out in the book? And if so, where?
I never thought you'd get my question.
I was at a meeting one night and a fellow indicated that he had been rocketed into the fifth dimension of existence. And I felt compelled to explain that that was a singing group and not a destination. I have come to understand that the fourth dimension of existence is the spiritual realm, which the tenth step says I have entered, unbeknownst to me, having taken action on the steps preceding, not completed the action, just taken action. And I think the first, second, and third dimensions are found on page 76.
But you might be wrong.
I could be wrong, yes, I could be. Don't mess my hair up, okay?
That was brilliant. That was wonderful. Okay, if God is everything, what is ego? Is ego God-given or a distortion of perception or something else? Well, the way we use ego, the way I use it is, it is a story maker-upper. And of course, God created story maker-uppers. It's definitely, as we recover, we realize that the perception was completely distorted and very painful. And as we destroy it and allow a new perception to come in, we start getting a glimpse of why God is everything. Until you do that, it's just a theory, and we're left with our own judgment and perception about everything. So it's a blessing to get out of there because it looks perfectly real. Thanks.
All right. In the foreword to the 12 and 12, on page 15, it states, AA's 12 steps are a group of principles spiritual in their nature, unquote. Nowhere does it state in the big book or 12 and 12 what those principles are and how they correspond to each step. I've read a couple different versions of what each principle to each step is, and there are differences. What is your opinion on experience with regard to this? Well, any question that asks my opinion is one of my favorite questions. In the I think it's in the big book in the second chapter, it says that the problem for the alcoholic centers in the mind. I think this question is an example of that. Simply how I think is my problem. S-H-I-T. And I don't mean to make light of the question. I'm not making light of the question. But Alcoholics Anonymous really doesn't care what I think. What Alcoholics Anonymous calls upon me to do is to take action. And with the action, I gain the experience. And with the experience, I come to an understanding of what it is that they're talking about. It's none of my business what Hazleton thinks of this. We're Betty Ford. We're Father Martin. Alcoholics Anonymous, contained in the big book, the program of recovery contained in the big book, is what works for alcoholics. I'm alcoholic. Left to my own devices, I'll think my way right out of this program. So I can't answer the question. All I know is I've got a better way of life today than I've ever had before in my entire history. So I think I'll stop doing it. That's my best thinking. Yeah. Thank you.
I can't answer it either. Sandy, when we detach ourselves from our own lives, allowing God to be in charge, letting go of the world around us, others in society around us have a tendency to say we are selfish, even self-centered. How would you reply? I wouldn't.
Thank you.
I wouldn't say anything to them. People that are centered on God are going to cause other people to be uncomfortable, and it's going to appear that we're not being treated fairly.
What have been some of your aha moments in your spiritual growth? I think one of the best things about getting together and sharing our stories is we share with each other those things that have happened in our lives which cannot be explained, which I call God shots. And I was, I think we were speaking earlier this morning at the house. As many of you know, I used to be a circuit court judge, and I sent a lot of people to prison, and we've got a prison in Hagerstown, and we were at Founders Day, and if you've been to Founders Day and you've gotten the package, you eat in the dining hall, and you sit where they tell you to sit, and you live in the dormitory, and every meal, you go through the buffet, and you sit where they tell you to sit, and every meal, somebody new sits across from you. And so I'd had that experience for those 3 days on Saturday. Now it's Sunday, and I went down to the dorm head to shower up, and a guy comes in, and he says, "Hi, my name's Woody. I'm from Baltimore." And I said, "I'm Jack from Hagerstown." He said, "Ah, I come to Hagerstown all the time." I said, "What do you come up there for, Woody?" I figure he's a truck driver or something. He says, "Me and my sponsor, we bring a meeting to that prison in Hagerstown every month." I said, "Woody, I'm embarrassed to talk to you because I live 10 miles from that prison and I don't know a single person who takes a meeting in there." And he said, "Well, would you like to go with us?" I really like to talk to you about that, Woody, but I got to get back to my room. My man Glenn's waiting for me back there, so we'll talk about this later. And I went back to the room, and I told Glenn what had happened. He said, "Jack, did you give him your telephone number?" I said, "Oh, no." He said, "Jack, there are 15,000 people here this weekend." He said, "He will never find you." And I took comfort in that. So we went over to the dining hall and went through the buffet line and got my tray of food, and now they're telling me where to sit. "Every seat, every seat, every seat, every seat. Sit down here, Jack." I sit down. "Every seat, every seat, every seat." Now they're coming down the other side, and I wonder who's going to sit across from me. Woody. Now, the last thing I want to do as a retired circuit court judge is to take meetings into prisons. But what are the odds of Woody sitting directly across from me? That's a God shot. And even a knucklehead like me can recognize God moving in my life. But I got to be open. I got to be willing. And I started taking meetings into prisons, and it's been the best thing I've ever done, or one of the best things I've ever done. And if you ever get invited to take a meeting into a jail or a prison, my My encouragement is go and let God operate in your life, because they wouldn't invite you if God didn't intend for you to go.
Great, Jack. Thank you. Most alcoholics grew up in an alcoholic home. Does AA help them with their alcoholic relatives, or should they be in Al-Anon? What's the difference between AA and Al-Anon if we follow the same steps and traditions? Well, we have a thing in AA that we have a common problem and a common solution. And our common problem is different than the Al-Anon's common problem, which is living with an alcoholic instead of being an alcoholic. So they hold the perspective so that the process of identification is one person who's going crazy living in an alcoholic family with another person who's gone crazy in an alcoholic family, sharing how the steps can lift you up so that it won't even matter if the alcoholic doesn't get sober. That's one of the powerful things of AA, of Al-Anon, is that they talk about, this is not going to cause your husband to get sober, but it's going to cause you peace of mind no matter what he does. That's a pretty powerful thing. Thank you.
What do you think this says?
In self-forgetting, I find, what does it mean? Oh, use this as a quote and then ask the question down below.
Okay.
It was misleading, huh?
In self-forgetting, I find. What does it mean or how? Selfishness and self-centeredness is going to kill me. It's going to take me to my grave. Unless I stop drinking and start changing. And start changing is the deal. And it's not that I think any less of myself, but I think about myself less. That is that four-step thing that is suggested to us in the 10th step is to get God into the game early on when resentment or anger or fear show up. Talk to somebody about it, i.e. call my sponsor. Make amends quickly and resolutely turn my attention to what I can do to help somebody else. I don't know about you, but that is against my nature. I believe I've heard our speaker say that when he first came to Alcoholics Anonymous, he was a little Johnny One Note. Do, re, mi, 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 mi.
I forgot that.
And I was a little Johnny One Note. I identify with that. Me, 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 me. And I find in Alcoholics Anonymous that this is a program that teaches me to be selfless, to think about myself less, and to think about what I can do to fit myself to be of maximum service to God and to my fellow man. And as a result of that, by just the practice of those new habits, self-forgetting, I forget about myself. Selfishness and self-centeredness slip away.
Thanks, Jack. Uh-oh, this looks like a volume.
Oh, I'll be back.
I believe that AA is a part of a destiny. Awakening human potential for good. We function for the most part below the radar. Consistent with our principles of anonymity, is there a way to share the message with humanity generally that would awaken more people? Or do we rely on God to leak the good news and when others are ready? As I write this, I think I know the answer to my own question. Okay, but I think we all think that. And I think they thought that in the beginning when they said, we could help every single human being who is meant lost, desperate, restless, irritable, discontent. But look how they help alcoholics, by a program of attraction. You don't see your home group advertising on television, and you don't see that you get a celebrity from your own group to say, "I'm sober, come on in." And Bill wanted to promote this thing. We got to get the millions all over the world. Even as he was dying, he was going, "We got to get all of them." And God said, "We'll get there, but not at your pace. It'll be at my pace. One drunk talking to another." And so we've all felt this. But you can't do any better than helping the next person. And if you've ever been to Omaha, and Peggy Martin, whenever she talks, have you all seen this? And she says, "Before I get started, I'd like the women I sponsor to stand up." You've seen it, Jack. And so they stand up. There's quite a few girls. And then she said, "Now I'd like all the people that they sponsor to stand up. And then I'd like all the people that they sponsor." Jeez, it looks like the whole room stands up. One person. So it's getting there. Just not the way we would do it. Thanks.
Bill W. wrote in As Bill Sees It on page 264, "The steps can keep most of us sober and somehow functioning. But step 11 can keep us growing if we try hard and work at it continually." End quote. This has been my experience. My ego will want others to see and understand this because it was so helpful to me. How do we convey the importance of step 11? Keeping in mind, live and let live, and our singleness of purpose. The step that's addressed in this question is step 11, and that step says that I am to seek. I think that was a word that was mentioned earlier about becoming a seeker. God could and would if he were sought. I remember hearing a speaker who I admire used to talk about playing hide and seek. How much time was spent playing hide and seek? Well, we would spend hours playing hide and seek. My sponsor used to ask me if I spent more than an afternoon at the Broad Axe drinking. I said, "Oh, yeah, I've gone there many times at noon." "What time did you come out?" "I came out at 1 a.m. "Oh, you spent 13 hours drinking?" "Yeah." "Have you ever spent 13 straight hours seeking God? Through prayer and meditation, praying only for knowledge of God's will for me and the power to carry that out?" Well, the answer is no. I've never done that for 12 straight hours consciously. But I've come to understand that this whole program is a prayer, and this is God's solution for the alcoholic. God has other solutions for other people in the universe. It's none of my business what God's will is for them. What is my business is what is God's will for Jack. And I've come to understand that when I take the inventory process and weave it together with prayer and meditation, I'm given an unshakable foundation for daily life. And given the life that I used to live, people just in observing the way I live my life today know that something's changed. And live and let live. I can't change anybody else, but I can sure work on changing me. Thank you.
Thanks, Jack. Good man. Oh, here's an easy one. Little.
Yeah, both sides.
Well, here's a similar thing. I feel like I'm growing in AA program more than my sponsor. He has a very laid-back style, and I don't feel like I'm not working the steps very... Like, I'm not working stuff for authority, maybe he isn't. Is it time to find a new sponsor? And if so, how do I tell him? Well, I'm not a very good one to answer this because I've had the same sponsor for 42 years. And myself, when I came in, you didn't select your sponsor. He came to your house, and it was a done deal. So I just thought it was for life. So the thought of changing never occurred to me. But today's a different world, and you made the decision in the first place. And I don't know how to handle that. I don't know what you do when you go, well, I don't know if this decision was good, because I never had to wrestle with that. It was done, and you just didn't question it. And as I said earlier, I got other advisors, and I continue to have. I have four or five advisors that I run stuff by on a regular basis. And I'll call Jack, or I'll call Tom Meyer. If I'm sponsoring somebody and I don't know how to handle it, I've never had anybody with this, I call around the country till I find somebody who did handle it, and then I come back and pass on the thing, but I don't tell them I didn't think it up. I'm not that humble.
Keep working. I am a producer of musicals. They need to be planned in advance. It is a process. I deal with musicians, technical lighting, and sound people, etc. Thinking about the past and the future. Am I spending my professional life in conflict with the present, the now, God? No.
That's a hard one, I'll admit.
Okay, I'm a trial lawyer. I'm going to make a bad situation better on Wednesday, but this is Saturday, and I'm not thinking about it. And I'll do the best I can, and I'll try to arrange the opening statement, the questions for the witnesses. I'll try to anticipate the answers. I'll have a closing argument outlined, and my defendant will probably plead guilty. Am I wasting my time? No, I'm doing my job. I'm doing the best I can to get it all organized, but the outcome, not up to me. I was talking with somebody earlier today that there's that guy down in Houston, Joel Olstein. Joel wrote himself a book, many of you may have it, read it, Your Best Life Now. You mentioned Eckhart Tolle, The Power of Now. We got a book. There is one that has all power. That one is God. May you find him now. They're taking our stuff and selling it back to us for $28 a book. We got the answers. How am I doing now? Right here, right now. Things seem to be okay. Organizing activities, workday activities. I take on responsibilities. I discharge responsibilities. I'm doing much better today now that I'm not drinking. Isn't that what I'm supposed to be doing? Thank you.
Thanks, Jack. And I was just thinking, they still have flops, don't they? Okay.
Musicals?
Yeah.
No.
A spiritual teacher once said, 99 cents does not make a dollar in regards to self-realization, God-realization. It happens all at once and spontaneously. You cannot meditate your way to enlightenment. In AA, we see Bill's sudden awakening, but are also told many of us have more gradual awakenings. Is it possible to make progress towards awakening? Is awakening a progress? Progress, not perfection. Let's look at what William James would call the educational variety. So that you don't come in here and you say to God, God, please help me. I want to, boom, the lights go on and all of that. So let's look at the experience of the gradual, okay? I think we find it after we do the ninth step. That's a long process. We have been one step at a time chugging along. And then it says, we suddenly realize that God is doing for us what we could not do for ourselves. So even the gradual one happens suddenly. It happens in that instant when you have a singular moment. Only it wasn't like Bill's where you're lying there. You're just doing this work. You're not focusing on trying to have one of these. And it happens. But it does happen suddenly. I think everybody's is sudden. So that's all I'll say on that.
As the spiritual life is sought through awakening, how does the life of service work change? Is there a profound change in service to others as we seek God more closely? And are service and seeking inexorably interwoven? Well, certainly service work is an important part of Alcoholics Anonymous, but service work, as I understand it, is seeking and doing God's will in my life as it relates to this program of recovery, and it may well be that whatever it is that God wills for you will be entirely different than what God wills for me. It just strikes me that what we're all called upon to do is to be of service. And that can be setting up chairs, making coffee, sponsoring somebody, being a GSR or DCM or a delegate. There are lots and lots of different ways to be of service in terms of the recovering community. But it's different for each and every one of us. God's will is not the same for all of us, as I understand it. And my experience, at least in Alcoholics Anonymous, has been that step 10 calls upon me to grow in effectiveness and to grow in understanding by applying these principles to my life on a daily basis. And my experience has been, to the extent that I try to do that, things go pretty well. And to the extent that I don't do that, things don't go so good. And so for the alcoholic, suiting up and showing up and doing the deal is what it's all about. And not quantifying or qualifying the quality or the value, I don't need to know, because it's a God deal. God knows why he has me doing what I do. I have no idea. And every now and then, God will do a bank shot just to show off, to let me know that I'm doing what I'm supposed to be doing, even though I think that this is a total waste of time. And so I don't have to examine it and quantify it or qualify it. I just need to suit up and show up.
Thanks, Jack. All right, let's do I'll do one, you do one, I'll do one, and we'll quit. I mean, we'll take a break.
Okay.
When I came to AA, I was self-righteously contemptuous of religion then, like you talk about. I encountered God as you experience him. I try to be open-minded, and I am about most beliefs, but I have a knee-jerk negative reaction about Christianity. I'm uncomfortable about this. Any suggestions? Well, this is a heck of a beginning for you to put this question out and to just open it out, indicating you would like to get rid of this painful belief that you have. I mean, you can't make a better beginning than to do that. We want to get rid of this opinion that we have because it's causing us to suffer. And I think society is pushing us in this direction, or there's just forces that seem to want to pick on this. And I've started to comment on that, that you can mention any higher power you want in AA. You can mention John Wayne. You can mention your home group. You can mention, my higher power is the whole spirit of the universe. My higher power is Muhammad. My higher power is this. You say your higher power is Jesus, somebody's going to call you on it. We seem to have singled that one higher power out for a negative blast in the middle of our fellowship, and we all need to take a look at that, because there's a lot of people's souls are offended, and they stay quiet at meetings when this criticism is going on, but they're being deeply hurt by such comments. So this is a wonderful thing for all of us to inventory. What prejudice do we have left and get rid of them? Because no one, I'll tell you this, no one wants to listen to an angry person. So when you're trying to sponsor or do anything, if you're an angry person, your message just gets wiped out by the anger. So there we go.
If you take no causes or sides, how will the innocent be protected? I am an alcoholic, and I suffer from a spiritual malady. And up until 1935, there was no hope for me. I mean, in all of recorded history, there's never, ever been an answer for an alcoholic. And the innocent have suffered the entire time. And then on June the 10th, 1935, that spark was struck in Akron, and there was hope for the alcoholic. And I've got a book that says that my purpose in being is to fit myself, to equip myself, to be of maximum service to God and to others. That may or may not include protecting the innocent, because I don't know what God's will is for me in that regard. But I do know that I've been given the opportunity, I've been given a gift by God to affect the life of another alcoholic in a way no other person can. And I think I'm called upon, to the very best of my ability, to keep my focus on what I can do to help another alcoholic, so that we, all of us, can do what I was totally incapable of doing by myself. And the innocent will continue to suffer.
Okay. We'll wrap it up with this. We'll take a 10-15 minute break, okay? Can you tell us about the Marines and the outhouse? Which is these photographs, if you haven't seen. There's a bunch of Marines sitting around a table with a miniature outhouse, and then there's one with me standing in front of
them. That's you?
That's me.
Ooh. I'm so sorry.
All right, so this was in 1963, and I ended up in a MABS outfit in Iwakuni, Japan, and that's a squadron that has no airplanes. It's a base squadron. It takes care of all the housekeeping, the group guard, the building the explosive ordnance and the chemical weapons. And I had the air traffic control and the motor transport, supply, you name it. It's all the housekeeping. So when the squadrons go to happy hour, all the fighter squadrons and attack squadrons, they got big models of their airplane on the tables. And then they're all getting drunk around the symbol of their squadron. And we had no symbol. And we had the most creative guy, Jack Perrin. He was a captain. He was the executive officer, and he built that miniature. We called it an S house. And it was a perfect replica of a one-holer. It had a toilet, had the seat, had a little tiny roll of toilet paper. It was just perfectly, because he ran the carpentry shop. So we put it on the table, and that was our symbol. And so when the pilots from the fighter squadron would come over and say, "What the hell is that?" And I said, "That's our symbol. Look at it. Look at the workmanship. Look inside." And when they looked inside, there was a sign that said, "You will buy a round of drinks quietly." And then we'd all sing, "You're in the shit house now, you're in the shit house now." And then we told that guy, "Now you can sign it. And if you get somebody to look in there, you'll get a free drink." So he'd go get one of his buddies. "Hey, you ought to see that damn thing those guys go." When we left Iwo Kuni, there was no room for signatures. And it was famous. So this same guy, this leads into the most classic military story I've ever heard. This same guy talked our colonel into writing to the group CO, telling him that we had been notified by the commandant of the Marine Corps that we were going to get an airplane, and what would our call sign be, and the frequency. And so the group CO, to play along, wrote back, "When your plane arrives, you can call it Wormwood 1. That was the call sign, Wormwood. Little did anyone know, but this captain was building an airplane out in the carpenter shop out of wood and canvas, wheels from something. He had an old pump engine in there. They carved a propeller. From a distance, it looked like a real, maybe an observation plane or something. And one morning at about 6 a.m., they towed the plane out to the flight line with a radio jeep, and they called the tower, and the engine's running. And so at 6 in the morning, the tower hears, "Iwo Kuni Tower, Wormwood 1, over." And of course, there's no Wormwood. And they go, "Wormwood 1, where are you?" He says, "I'm on the ham's flight line." And they got the binoculars on. They see a freaking plane over there with its engine going, which did not come aboard the base in any official fashion. There's no record of Wormwood 1. And they said, "Well, what are your intentions?" "I'd like to taxi time in the altimeter. I want to go take off." And they said, wait a minute. So they sent the car over with the red lights to see what this was. And then we exposed it all, and everybody laughed, and the military police called the tower, and the tower laughed, and everybody had a big joke, and boy, that was funny. So Wormwood got parked in front of our Quonset Hut headquarters, and we had Santa Claus in them, and it starts falling apart, and it's just, you'd think it was the end of Wormwood, until we got noticed that we were going to deploy to Taiwan for an exercise with the Taiwanese Air Force. And this same captain goes to our colonel and says, "Well, let's write a letter to the group CO and find out what flight Wormwood is flying over in so that we know when to leave and go to Taiwan." And the group CO writes back and says, "Wormwood will fly over with the photo planes," because they're all playing a joke. I mean, they're just going along. Freaking Jack Perrin, he cuts the wings off the plane, folds them up on the side, ties it all together, and with no authorization, takes it down to the transport planes that are hauling all the supplies over there. And it's not on the manifest. And they're going, "What is this?" "Well, it's the group CO. It's his observation plane for government." And real pilots looked at that thing and went, "Okay." So we went there 2 weeks early to build the camp, build all the shit houses, the showers, the mess hall, the tents, and everything, and the radar. So the group CO leads the flight over when all the planes are coming. He lands and he looks, and the first thing he sees sitting on the flight line is Wormwood, and he knew it didn't fly over. And he was furious. And he found Jack Perrin and he said, "Burn it." And turned around and left. That was the end. Just burn it. And that's not the end of Wormwood, because Jack Perrin went over to the Chinese general who was in charge of the Air Force Academy and the exercises, and he requested an appointment, and the general let him in. And he said, "Sir, I'm here to make a present to you of a special gift that MAG-12 constructed for you. It's a composite of all the prop planes that flew in World War II in support of China and Chiang Kai-shek." And the general almost had tears. He thought it was so wonderful. And he said, "Well, we're going to have a ceremony to accept the..." So Jack went back to the colonel and said, "You don't want me to burn that Chinese general's airplane, do you?" And he said, "What, what?" And he said, "Yeah, he thinks you're a hero." We had a military ceremony. And they brought their little tractor thing over, and they're playing the music, the bugles and drums, and Wormwood is being towed off. And 2 weeks later, somebody came down and said, "You won't believe it. You go up to the courtyard of the Air Force Academy." We went in there. We'd never been in there. And in this courtyard, there were two pedestals. And on one of them was a MiG-15 that had defected from mainland China. And on the other one was Wormwood. With a plaque under it that we couldn't read. And 8 years later, somebody we knew was over there, and it was still there. It was falling apart, but it was still there. And probably in the 70s, somebody in DCAA, I was telling him the story, and he said, "Geez, you ought to put that in Reader's Digest." And he said, "By the way, I just sold my house to the guy who used to be the commandant of that." He's the Chinese, Taiwanese air attaché to the United States. So we went and met him, and we described this, and he says, "Well, there's two planes there. I'll just call him and tell him to take pictures and send them over." And it wasn't Wormwood. I think Wormwood finally fell apart. So that's the background on that. So let's take a 15-minute break, and we'll come back. Is that a story? Have you ever heard one like that?